The Jewish Hour can now be heard on jcastnetwork.org, your portal to Jewish broadcasting. It's also on iTunes and on your smartphone using the Stitcher app. Welcome to the Jewish Hour and happy Lag BaOmer. I'm your host, Herschel Finman. We've got a wonderful show for you. Today is indeed the holiday of Lag BaOmer, celebrating the life of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and we'll probably throw some of that in the second half hour of the show. In this half hour of the show, we will be interviewing Ms. Elizabeth Reinecke, who's written a book and has put together a documentary, Chasing Portraits, A Great-Granddaughter's Quest for Her Lost Art Legacy. Her great-grandfather painted 800 paintings and deposited them around Poland before he was sent to the Warsaw Ghetto and eventually the Majdanek concentration camp where he died. But a lot of them got out, a lot of them survived. This is really interesting, this whole story over here. It's because it's Lag BaOmer, we get a reprieve in the music, and we get to listen to music today. And I'll talk about that again in the second half part of the show. The portion of the week, we may get to this too, is Bahar B'Chukosai. We end the book of Leviticus this week. We have a very cute Hasidic story. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. Shin Bet, that's the Israeli Internal Security Agency, sent out its monthly report for April, which lists 119 terrorist attacks by Palestinians on Israelis, compared to 118 for March. The April attacks caused two deaths, a British student and an Israeli soldier, and 16 people were wounded. Hamas in Gaza arrested one man on charges with collaborating with Israel in the death of Hamas terror cell leader Mazen Foucha. Foucha was shot in the head four times outside his Gaza City home by a Palestinian. 17-year-old Danish girl was charged with planning to bomb two schools in Denmark, including a Jewish one. The girl, who is not named, contacted the Islamic State after her trip to Turkey. She was arrested with bomb-making equipment. 17. President Trump appointed Howard Lorber, the president and CEO of the Vector Group, a New York holding company, and chairman of the real estate giant Douglas Elliman, to lead the Holocaust Memorial Council. The 68-year-old Jewish businessman served as an economic advisor on Trump's presidential campaign. A little payback there. And finally, if those of you who were wondering, it is permissible to play with fidget spinners on Shabbat. The latest toy craze has rabbis scratching their heads until rabbis at the Scientific and Technology Institute for Halacha in Jerusalem determined that the movement of the spinners does not violate the laws of Shabbos unless the spinners has lights that are triggered by the movement of the spinner. And now you know. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000, or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Herschel Finman, here you are listening to the Jewish Hour. We have online Elizabeth Reinecke, who's written a book and a documentary, Chasing Portraits, A Great-Granddaughter's Quest for Her her lost art legacy. How are you today, Elizabeth? I don't hear anything. Whoops. Is Elizabeth
Hello?
There? Oh, yes, now. It helps, yeah. helps to push the right button. Here we go. Okay, so thank you so much for coming on. We gave as an introduction to the show, my wife, Hannah, who is the arts and culture correspondent for the Jewish Hour, came across this story and said, this is a must. And I even got excited about it. So this is, I was just thinking on the way over and preparing some of the things I was going to say. And it occurred to me that the only thing that I have from my grandparents from Poland, and I don't even have it, my uncle has it, is a teapot. You have within your possession many paintings that your great-grandfather painted in Warsaw and were brought to America. And this is just like, when I was thinking about it, I said, wow, that is so awesome. So to have what you, to say that you have what you have, and then this whole pursuit of what else. So let's get some backstory about it. Tell us about your great-grandfather, please, Elizabeth.
Sure. So my great-grandfather, Moshe Ranecki, as you say in Polish, or Reinecki as we say now, was a Warsaw-based artist in the interwar year period, so the 1920s and 30s. And he painted scenes of Polish Jewish life in the 1920s and 30s and documented everyday life. So men playing chess, scenes from inside the synagogue, Talmudic study, women in the park playing with children. So he was an ethnographer of sorts and a chronicler of life in Poland, you know, well before the Holocaust and well before Hitler's time. And in the early days of the Second World War, he became concerned about his body of work. And so he decided to divide it up into bundles. It's believed there were close to 800 paintings and sculptures in the years leading up to September 1939. And he divided the paintings into these bundles and hid them with friends in and around the city of Warsaw with the idea that when the war was over, he would return and collect the bundles and the collection would be whole once again. And unfortunately, that's not what happened. He eventually ended up inside the Warsaw Ghetto and was deported, we believe, to Majdanek, and he perished. But some of my family survived, my dad and his parents and my great-grandmother, and they managed to collect a small fragment of the original body of work. And so we have that portion that they were able to collect. My Grandpa George always said it was a miracle that survived. And as you said, it's those objects and those links to the past that are really very profound.
Indeed. Let's talk a little bit about, I can imagine, Poland in the 1920s, your great-great-grandfather probably wasn't very thrilled that your great-grandfather was engaged in art, was he?
Indeed. You know, I know little about him. My understanding is that his name was Abraham, and that he was a tailor of some regard in Siedlce, which is just outside of Warsaw, and that he sewed uniforms for the military and also dabbled in real estate. And when Moshe was a young boy, he was just drawn to drawing and painting and the arts. And his father was not very pleased, both because of the prohibition against making art, of course, but also from a very practical standpoint of how the heck was his son going to make a living selling paintings, much a concern that many parents today have. And so he decided that he would marry Moshe off and that would be the end of it. And he would be married and have a family and he would have to get a real job. And ultimately, the woman that he was married to, Perla, they owned together an art supply store. And Perla managed the store and took care of it, which freed Moshe up to go out into the world and paint, which he did, and he also exhibited, and he was from documents that I've been able to dig up, it's amazing these documents survived, but was an active member of the organizations that promoted Jewish artists in Warsaw, and he exhibited and sold some pieces, and she made that happen for him.
Mm-hmm. And having an art supply store, if you're an artist, really comes in handy, I guess.
I think so. It was a clever purchase.
Indeed. Okay, so now, war-torn Warsaw. I mean, we use that as a generic term. When you say something looks like a disaster, you say it looks like post-war Warsaw. It's there was havoc and destruction. How is it that any of those 800 paintings were able to make it out of Warsaw or survive intact at all, Elizabeth?
Right. It's so true. So my understanding is that Warsaw was about somewhere between 80 and 90% destroyed. The package that Perla discovered was hidden in the Praga district, which is across the Wisła River in Warsaw. And Praga was less damaged than Warsaw, the main part of the city itself. And that was the package they recovered, and they assumed everything else had been destroyed, which made a lot of sense given all the bombings and fires and purposeful destruction of buildings. But what we've discovered is that more paintings survived, some of which we have some sense of a story of how they survived, but lots of nagging questions about the details, and others we just have no idea. So the Jewish Historical Institute in Warsaw today has 52 of my great-grandfather's pieces. And they bought various pieces over the years, and other pieces were donated, and how the people that brought them to the Jewish Historical Institute obtained them is really unknown. And so that's a big mystery. There's another small bundle of paintings that was saved by a farmer somewhere between Russia, Polish border, and Łódź. And we're not entirely clear how he obtained them, but they were eventually sold to Polish Jews who had been partisan fighters in Russia, and so that family today has some of those paintings.
Okay,
all these different pieces.
This is all very fascinating. So you were raised. Did you know your great grandmother? Did you ever meet her?
No, she died after I was born, and she actually knew about my birth, but she did briefly live in the United States. She moved to Le Mans, France, after being in the U.S. for a short period of time, and so I never met her.
Okay, but the painting, you grew up with your great-grandfather's paintings.
I did. So between my parents' home and my grandparents' home, there were a significant number of paintings on display, and they were just part of my childhood. They were there, and, you know, when you're a kid, you don't necessarily ask the right questions and know what it is that you're looking at. But the wonderful thing about that, on the other hand, is that I came to understand the paintings on my own terms, and they were just part of my everyday life, which is really an incredible thing that today I'm very grateful for.
Mm-hmm. So like you were like 10, 11 years old, your friends would come over and they'd say, hey, what's the story with all these paintings you got? And you say, oh, those are just my great-grandfather's. That type
of
a thing?
Well, pretty much. Yeah. You know, it's funny, when your parents have things, you assume that they've always been there and will always be there, and you don't really ask those questions. So I don't remember a lot of conversations with my school friends, but I do remember them, and I always think of the people in the painting sort of as these characters, and I have a certain fondness for certain people and certain paintings because over the years they just really grown on me, and you know, some people have photographs and we have the paintings, and so the people in the paintings really sort of whisper across the decades and help us to remember a people and a community and a time and a place that, of course, was destroyed by the Holocaust. And so I feel really fortunate to know the people in the paintings. And while the paintings can't speak, we can speak for them and try to remember that history and to share it with others. And for that, I feel both an incredible burden and an incredible honored obligation to do so.
Okay, if you're just joining us, our guest today is Elizabeth Reinecke, who has written a book and documentary, Chasing Portraits, A Great-Granddaughter's Quest for Her Lost Art Legacy. So at what point, you got this stuff going, it's just like part of the wallpaper. And at what point did you begin, quote-unquote, chasing portraits then, Elizabeth?
So that has been sort of this multi-decade journey. My grandpa George died in 1992, and when he passed away, we discovered that he had been working on a memoir that we did not know about. And in the memoir, he talked about life in Poland before the war, and a lot of memories about family events and his father's passion for painting. And when we discovered that memoir, there was one passage in particular that really spoke to me. And it said, I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, it said something like, I'm writing this memoir if for no other reason than for my granddaughter Elizabeth to know the truth and to not be afraid of it.
Wow.
And yeah, I still I get chills every time I think about it. And that was this incredible moment where I thought, okay, I am not a survivor and I cannot bear witness, but I feel this incredible obligation to tell my family's story. And in graduate school, a number of years after that, I wrote my master's thesis about children of Holocaust survivors. I was really interested in Art Spiegelman's Mouse books and tried to understand how children of survivors could have a voice within Holocaust discourse, even though they weren't survivors. And then I had this moment where I realized that the paintings were something I could do something about. And in the late 90s, we decided to build a website to showcase my great-grandfather's paintings. And it was shortly after building the website that we were contacted by Yad Vashem, the museum, of course, the Holocaust History Museum in Israel, with a request to donate a painting to them, which we eventually did. And it really clicked for me then that these paintings weren't just things in my house, that they were socially and historically incredibly important, and I decided that I wanted to advocate for them. And so I would say those series of things set me off on this journey, and then when we discovered that other paintings had survived, that really clicked the whole Chasing Portraits project into place, and I started to make the documentary film, and funding became incredibly difficult, so I thought, forget the film, I'll write the book. And then once the book became, picked up a publisher, then people were more willing to fund the film. And so the book is done and out and available, and the film is in post-production, and we're really close to we're close to the finish line. I'm hoping to be in film festivals perhaps by the end of the year or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, people know about the woman in gold, the Edith Bloch Bauer, which painted by Scheel, and the whole thing that went with that. And that was like a whole big thing. That was like one painting and the big fight that had to happen with it. And the whole thing over there is that's our painting and I want it back. And understandable for what the owner of it sold that painting for, I can understand. What's your motivation, Elizabeth Reinecke, in pursuing your grandfather's paintings?
I love that question because although my story is certainly parallel to the Bloch Bauer painting, there are definite differences. And one of the big differences for me is that my great-grandfather actually painted the painting, and that it's art from Poland and documents the Jewish community. So all those things intertwined make it a little different. My goal is to restore my great-grandfather's legacy and to share the art with others. And so I have been early on in this process, I spoke to some attorneys and I said, that's our art and we should get it back. And they said, well, that's all nice, but here's what you need to prove that. And here's how long, you know, this process can take and how expensive it might be to pay for attorney time and provenance researcher's time. And you have to understand that every single painting is a different case. You can't just sit lump them all together and have that be a singular case. And so at some juncture, I said, well, you know what? What if we don't pursue this as an issue of restitution and return? And instead, I pursue it as a historian. In other words, I try to find all the paintings. I try to let people know, the people that have the paintings, to know that I won't come and fight them for the paintings. And so they will perhaps be more willing to open their doors and let me in. I'd like to create a catalogue raisonné, in other words, a document that documents everything we know about my great-grandfather's art, both those paintings that we have found and have and the ones that are missing. In other words, we have photographs of paintings, but we don't know if they survived the war and if so, where they are. And so my efforts really have been more as an art historian and to try to better share the story. And so that's what I've been working on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So would you say that this is an art for art's sake or great-grandfather for great-grandfather's sake?
Probably all of the above. It's a very emotional thing that I just feel passionate about because, frankly, if I don't do it, I don't think anybody else would. And I think that that the story is profound and important. You know, I think photographs of the Jewish community, particularly in Eastern Europe before the war, are incredible. So, of course, Roman Vishniak's photographs are very well known, but there are other photographers whose work survived the war and is incredibly powerful. But the thing with a photograph is that it is of a particular person. And when you look at the photograph, you see that person. The thing that's profound about my great-grandfather's paintings is that other children of survivors and the Jewish community in general, when they look at those paintings, they see in it a sense of life and a sense of community and people. And there is a connection that I think doesn't always happen in a photograph. And so that brings me great joy to be able to share that and to be able to discover more pieces that tell us more about a community that is gone. And so I have this passion and persistence and perseverance about it and not always entirely sure where it comes from, but I feel like it's really important. I feel like a lot of times when we think about Polish Jewish history, we just think about the Holocaust. And I think it's really important to remember what came before and that there was a thriving Jewish community. And that there were a lot of artists, and not only my great-grandfather, and their work deserves to be known and taught in art history classes and Jewish education classes and in all sorts of different ways that bring a more rounded understanding of Polish Jewish history.
That is fascinating. I'm just like totally and completely blown away. So it was estimated that your great-grandfather painted 800 paintings. What percent of the paintings would you say have you been able to track down in these last two decades, Elizabeth?
So my family has about 120 pieces. And then the next largest collection that we know of is at the Jewish Historical Institute in Warsaw, which has 52. And then there are different collectors, private collectors, in Poland, Israel, Canada, and the U.S. Some of those we have seen, but not all of them. And so, you know, it's still a small percentage. I think that there's something like 600 or so paintings that I'm still in theory looking for. Of course, I will never find them all, and I will never know precisely what's out there just because clearly so much was lost in the war, and I just hope that more pieces keep turning up.
Mm-hmm. How is that success going? I understand dealing with, say, like a person who was Polish national, whatever, has some of the paintings, and you call them up and say, listen, I think you have some of my great-grandfather's paintings. Their reaction, I could imagine, is not so great. I imagine, why didn't my aunt went back to Poland? She was raised, my grandmother was not a survivor. She came out in, after World War I, and there was always letters going back and forth to the shtetl, so she knew of the address of her grandparents' house in this shtetl. So she went to Poland. Mm. She went to this place. She knocked on the door, and she said, my grandfather used to live here. And the person slammed the door in her face and never opened the door again. So have you been getting door slams? Or are people like saying, oh, you're an art historian, and of course this is for the better of mankind, or something in the middle, or neither, or both?
Well, both. There have been some people who have been incredibly kind and said, come to my home, come see the paintings, bring your film crew, take photographs, and they have been delightful part of the conversation. Some people have been hesitant at first and then let me in, and there have been other people who have said no. And all of those are in the book, for sure. I think that it's complicated, and that is why I've tried to emphasize that I am a historian. But I do think that, you know, history is both complicated and an emotional thing for people. And, yeah, it's hard. I can't speak for everyone, you know, their own decisions about how they pursue these things. I will say this. If somebody has one of my great-grandfather's paintings, first, I would love to come see it. And the second thing is that if they don't want it or they're unable to care for it, I would be delighted to have it gifted to our family. So I'm always eager to see more art. But the pursuit of fighting for it, there's enough fighting in the world, and I would like to have it be less about who has it and more about what it portrays and how it tells us more about my great-grandfather's body of work and Polish Jewish art history and the Polish Jewish community. To me, those underlying questions are more important. And, I don't want to fight. That's exhausting in a different way. And so I've tried to make it a more friendly, positive experience for everyone.
Mm-hmm. So at this point, would you say chasing portraits of your great-grandfather's legacy, is it a hobby, advocation, compulsion, addiction, obsession?
Yes, all of the above. I don't earn a living from it. It is definitely a hobby that has taken over my life. I feel incredibly thrilled to have finished the book. That was wonderful. I'm really excited to be narrowing in on finishing the film. And then I do need to take a breather. It has taken up several decades of my life, and I am hopeful that the story does continue and that I find more paintings, but there will, at least at this juncture, not be a second documentary and not a second film. I would love for someday to have an exhibit, you know, New York, Chicago, Detroit, LA, San Francisco. You know, it'd be great to be able to showcase the paintings at some of the Jewish art museums across the U.S. I think there definitely is interest in it. So maybe that would be the next project. But I do need to take a breather just because it's really an all-consuming project.
Mm-hmm. Art, do you have art shows planned? Anything in the hopper?
We do not. You know, it's been really an eye-opening experience. The Holocaust museums tell me it's fine art and they don't do fine art. And the Jewish museums tell me it's a Holocaust story, and they don't do the Holocaust. And so I have been left in a strange no man's land, and it's part why I chose to write the book and make the film.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. The style of art, looking at the pictures that you have in the book, remind me of another artist whose first name, his last name was Tammuz. I'm thinking it was Mordechai Tammuz or... I'm not exactly sure. I don't remember his name. And we came across him accidentally at an exhibit in the Jewish Museum in New York. And it was very, very much the similar type of thing. It was shtetl scenes that he painted I actually had the author on. He passed away 2 months after I interviewed him at like 95.
Oh my gosh.
And his stuff, I'm just trying to remember what his first name was, but he also, his kids did a website. So it seems like there would be a need for such displays of your work. How are your kids handling this advocation, Elizabeth?
My kids and my husband are incredibly supportive. I have had to travel for the project, and they just, you know, nothing but support. They've been fabulous. My kids definitely know the story. My youngest son has started to read the book and ask me questions, and that's important. So I'm really proud that he's interested and wants to know more. And my older son was involved in some of the shooting of the footage and is actually in a small scene in the movie, which is a pretty profound moment that to me really is about passing legacy on between generations. And so, you know, at some juncture, they'll have to figure out what role the story plays in their own lives. And all I can do is pass on the history and my pride in my great-grandfather's artwork as best as possible and hope that they make wise decisions about what they do with it.
Okay, wonderful. Our guest today has been Elizabeth Reinecke, written a book called Chasing Portraits, A Great-Granddaughter's Quest for Her Lost Art Legacy. You mentioned that the documentary is in final stages. Do you have a release date?
We do not, but I certainly will post it on my blog and my social media feed and also my newsletter. So if anybody wants to follow in any of those places, we'll always love to have more supporters come along for the ride and to be kept abreast of what's happening.
Okay, that is so awesome. I hope you keep us posted. I just liked your Chasing Portraits Facebook page and sent you a friend request on Facebook.
Fabulous.
So we can keep in touch. And I look forward to further developments of Chasing Portraits. Thank you so much, Elizabeth Reinecke, for coming on and sharing your story.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Okay, take care. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. Herschel Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. It is Lag BaOmer. Lag BaOmer today, the 33rd day of the counting of the Omer, marks the end or the cessation of a plague which afflicted Rabbi Akiva's students. Rabbi Akiva had the largest yeshiva probably ever, 24,000 students. And it says about Rabbi Akiva, he knew them all by first name. They all died, except for 5 of them, in a 33-day period, which is why we've been in a state of quasi-mourning, and one of those things was not playing live music. We've been playing a cappella music. And here, so that plague is over. So there are those people who say, that's it. We're done. We're good. This day happens to also mark another one of Rabbi Akiva's students. One of the 5 who survived died on this day. His name was Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And we'll talk about him a little bit later. And he wrote that when he dies, he doesn't want people crying. He wanted it to be called a hilula, a celebration. And demanded that people celebrate on his yahrzeit. So today in Meiron, the burial place, going on right this second, as a matter of fact, because it's getting on to the end of the day, hundreds of thousands of people flock to this little tiny town. It's got a bus station and a little Marcola, a little corner store, and a couple of houses. Not much. It's on top of the hill, just south of Tzfat. And people are really getting into it, and they stay up all night, and they party in honor of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. What are we going to do? We're going to play some music. So this is, since we're talking Israel, this is one of the up-and-coming Israeli recording artists. His name is Hanan Ben Ari, and this is Chizun, which means we'll see.
אני חושד שנעשיתי בינוני דווקא אחרי שכבר חשבתי שאני מתעלה באופן לא זמני במציאות גוררה את זיכרוני אני אדם מאפר באתי ולפה אני אשוב הרוח המנשבת בקרירה בכל מצב שמנסה אני לשמור על הגרוב אני מקדים ומאחר בפעימה אני צריך כיוון, איזון ולצאת מהניוון, מינון בין רוח נפש נשמה בין הרצון לעשייה יש רוח בים אדמה בין העירה לאהבה אתה צריך כיוון, איזון ולצאת מהניוון, מינון בין רוח נפש נשמה בין הרצון לעשייה יש רוח בים אדמה בין העירה לאהבה האם אפשר להיות קדוש ולהישאר נורמלי להיות חופשי בלי לעשות כל מה שבא לי להתבגר ולהישאר טוטלי להתאבד על החלום באופן רציונלי למצוא את הרגש בשגרת הריפית לשים תחפושת ולזכור את התכלית ליצור פאנקי פופ ולשמור על הביט ושעדיין יקראו לזה מוזיקה יהודית מכל הגלויות מהן הגעתי אפשר ליצור יבשת אפגניסטן, הונגריה ופרס המתחמשת אני רוצה מזוג עובר חפכים לזוג אבל בשביל שזה יהיה תענוג אני צריך כיוון, איזון ולצאת מהניוון בין רוח נפש נשמה בין הרצון לעשייה יש רוח מים אדמה בין העיר על האהבה אתה צריך כיוון, איזון ולצאת מהניוון מינון בין רוח נפש נשמה בין הרצון לעשייה יש רוח מים אדמה בין העיר על האהבה שחשבת, שחסכת, ברבות השנים מתגווה ממך עם ריבית של משכנתה. תאזן את הכוח, שלוט בלב עם המוח, ואז תוכל להשתחרר ולזרום ולחלום. אתה צריך אשפוז, חפוז, אחינו אל תהיה שבוז, תזוז, מן העצבות אל השמחה, מחידלון לעשייה, תצא מתוך ההפכה, מי שיעבוד לגאולה.
Assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
Hey, Schultzman, you're listening to the Jewish Hour. I came across this song. This was just, I like to do klezmer music. People complain when I don't do klezmer music. I have not come across any a cappella klezmer music. I keep on looking for that one, for those people who are into it, and I don't see any reason why not. I mean, maybe I'll just have to do one myself. Huh, don't hold your breath. But anyway, so this klezmer band is called Klezmer Chaos, and this song is called Froggy, and I will let you guess why this song is called Froggy. Do you or someone you know have an addiction to opiates? Ready to take your life back but don't have the time for a long inpatient program? MDS Drug Detox is a team of physicians with extensive experience in the field of rapid drug detox under anesthesia. MDS is the nation's only rapid opiate detox under anesthesia facility with the same doctors, RNs, and certified paramedics attending the entire drug detox process. MDS Drug Detox is safe and effective. Their goal is to provide the best, the safest, and the most economical way to free you from your addiction. MDS uses the highest standards of care and the best FDA-approved medications. MDS Drug Detox understands what your concerns are. Make the call today, 888-637-6968, or go online to www.mdsdrugdetox.com. That's 888-637-6968, MDS Drug Detox.
Schulfinman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. What would Lag BaOmer be without a rendition of Bar Yochai? So this group is called Lagum. It is an Israeli group, Sephardic of nature, and the song is simply called Bar Yochai, about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. Herr Schulfinman here. You are listening to The Jewish Hour.
Today is Lag BaOmer. We said the portion of the week is Bahar B'Chukosai, finishing off the book of Leviticus. But we're going to talk about Lag BaOmer and its significance. The first thing is the dealing with Rabbi Akiva, the reason for the quasi-mourning that we've been in. No live, no instrumental music for the last bunch of weeks, and we'll still have to do it for another 2 weeks. We don't cut our hair, we don't get married, buy new clothes, things like that. Things that are going to make a person happy when they could live without them. Rabbi Akiva, his main lesson was, V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, ze kol ha-Torah kula. Love your fellow as yourself is the entire Torah. And he just broke it down to just this one commandment from last week's portion, as a matter of fact, and said, well, you have all this other stuff. What's the point in believing in God? What's the point in keeping the Sabbath? What's the point in keeping kosher? What's the point in putting on tefillin and praying devoutly if you can't get along with another person? He says the whole purpose of doing all those things is to be able to get along. So then the question is, well, why was it that Rabbi Akiva's students died like that? What was the deal? Was this some sort of, and then suddenly it stopped. And it was only among Rabbi Akiva's students. So it wasn't like this pandemic. So it says the reason why that they died is because they weren't getting along with each other. Now, and you think about it. Okay, understood. Rabbi Akiva's whole thing was getting along with other people. But these people had to be interviewed by Rabbi Akiva. They were students. They learned what Rabbi Akiva taught. And they knew this lesson. They knew his mantra of, pardon the expression, love your fellow as yourself. So where was their intolerance? Here this is very cute. It's not so cute because they all died. But they all understood there's 24,000 students. So 24,000 students means 24,000 different opinions at least. So each one believed, when they would listen to a lecture of Rabbi Akiva, that they were the ones who understood it properly, and it was their duty, since those other students didn't understand it as properly as they did, to convince that person that they should understand the lesson as they themselves understood Rabbi Akiva. And you can understand this led to discord. And the Almighty said, well, this isn't productive. We're going to start all over again. And Rabbi Akiva started out with five students. And Rabbi Akiva is responsible for the entire oral tradition. His number one student was the person in charge of making the Mishnah, which became the Talmud. His number two student, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, was in charge of making the Zohar, the esoteric. And so it goes, and he's responsible for the Medrash and the Halacha. All of this is all according to Rabbi Akiva. In addition to that, today is the passing, as we mentioned at the onset of the show, of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai compiled the Zohar, which is the esoteric insights into the Bible, all the real deep Kabbalistic stuff that the Kabbalah and Hasidus is based on. And he said about the Zohar that Abraham brought merit into the world enough to last from Abraham's time to Rabbi Shimon's time, which is about the year 150, 200. Rabbi Shimon then said, the Zohar will give merit to the Jewish people and to the world until the coming of the Mashiach. It's enough that there's a Zohar in existence to keep the world in existence. And we look, it's called, the Lubavitcher Rebbe referred to Lag BaOmer as the Matan Torah of Pnimius of a Torah. In about 3 weeks, we'll be celebrating Shavuos, the revelation of the giving of the Torah. That was the written Torah. This is the oral Torah and the inner dimensions of the Torah. And that's what we're celebrating today. Speaking of celebrating, we've got to take a quick commercial break and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Specs Howard. The Specs Howard School of Media Arts is proud to have been a sponsor of The Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding comes from its sponsors, listeners like you help keep The Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to The Jewish Hour, 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. That's 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. Your help is greatly appreciated. Thank you very much.
Herschel Finman here. You are listening to The Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? Easiest way? RabbiFinman.com. You contact me, I'll contact you. We'll become good buddies. Anything you want to contact me about. I don't know if I'll get to it today if you contact me. Usually I do it on Sunday afternoon, but today is Lag B'Omer, and there is the grand Lag B'Omer barbecue. This is how we celebrate it in Israel. They like bonfires. We had a bonfire last night that went over really well. It was very nice at 1725. Today we're having a barbecue, all-you-can-eat burgers and dogs. And, of course, there is a charge. Go on the JewishFerndale.com website and pay for it, and then come on down. We'll also find archived editions of the show. You'll have find archived editions of the other things that I'm working on. And you will find the donations page, which we're in the middle of May. We still have to pay for April. So step up to the plate. Go to the computer. You know the drill. I've been saying it for 21 years. And Baruch Hashem, for 21 years, you, people like you, have been coming through. So instead of it being people like you, it should be you. Go to the computer, donate, do a small amount if big amounts aren't good enough for you, or good for you, and make it a monthly thing. You could do that too. It's all PayPal, it's safe, secure. Don't like doing internet giving? No problem. Drop your donation of any denomination into an envelope and put a stamp on it currently good enough to get it to me at Jewish Hour, 1725 Pinecrest, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. When I was in Montreal, there was a person there who I became friendly with. His name was Yaakov Brower. He was a professor of neuroendocrinology at McGill University, which means he studied a really small part of people's brain. That was his whole universe. He retired and he got involved with doing lecturing and speaking, and he had his whole things like this. So he decided he would be brought down for what was called the Encounter Weekends in Crown Heights, and he would talk to college students. And as wont was be, he got burnt out. He just got tired of giving the same lecture and answering the same questions. And so he decided he wasn't going to do it anymore. So he did it one more time. And he gave his lecture, he gave his speech, and he felt it wasn't the best. He wasn't putting himself into it. It was like, you know, as far as he was concerned, he bombed. So afterwards, somebody came up to him and said, "This is really fantastic. Where have you written about this?" And he said, "I'm not a writer. Okay, I've never written about this." And the person says, "Oh, too bad. You should really get into writing." The next day, the whole group of these participants were scheduled to go before the Rebbe for dollars and receive the Rebbe's blessing. And he was sitting in the lobby of the hotel, and someone came up to him and said, "Professor Brower, that was such a great thing. Where's your writing?" And he just said, "No, I don't write. I've never written anything. I'm a speaker." And he said, "Come on, you're a college professor. You had to have written stuff." And he said, "There's a big difference between writing about a pituitary gland than there is about writing about God." He says, "I can't do that." As they were walking together to 770, another person came up to him and said, "Dr. Brower, that was terrific. Where can I read more about what you were talking about?" And he just ignored it. When he came before the Rebbe, he wasn't going to tell the Rebbe, "This is the last time I'm doing this," but he just told the organizers, "It's the last time I'm doing this." When he got to the Rebbe gave him a dollar and then gave him what was a decent bracha, a good bracha, bracha vatzlacha, you should be blessed and successful. And then the Rebbe said, "Here's an extra dollar for the future writings in which you will be engaged." And so he walked out, he looked at somebody and he said, "I guess I'm a writer." That's going to do it. We hope you have a great Lag B'Omer. Do something Lag B'Omer-esque. Start a bonfire, do a barbecue, learn some inner aspects of the Torah. You can do that by going to RabbiFinman.com. We hope we had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope you had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you have a great week. Take care.